Well, I need to make no explanation to you about the abilities and the of our brother Carl and the benefits that we have received from his ministry. We are glad that he is able to be here, considering the personal experiences which he is now going through. And we know that he is trusting in the Lord and in these. And we're looking forward to his ministry and that which he brings to us. The topic which he will speak on is I and my beloved. I and my beloved. Brother Carl.
Well, brethren, it is good to be with you, even though this year will be for a short period of time. Before we go into our remarks, I have a message from my earthly beloved, Sister Marge. She sends very special greetings to all of you. I was with her yesterday afternoon in the hospital. She has appreciated very much your thoughts and your prayers, the phone calls and the cards that she's received. These have all been very helpful to her. Her condition continues to improve. Her strength is so strong that yesterday before I came, she insisted on giving me a back rub. So you can say that she's the same Sister Marge as always. Although there is evidence that the cancer is spreading, nevertheless, she is in very good spirits, and there is hope that it can be somewhat contained through treatments that she'll be getting. But she did ask, please deliver her very special love to the convention. She had hoped until a week ago, even after entering the hospital, that she could be dismissed for 1 week and be here and then go back for the balance of her treatment, but that was not to be permitted. The hymn that we sang at the beginning of this talk is a hymn I think we all recognize as one that you cannot do what you so often do as Bible students, sing the first and second verse, or sing the first verse only. It's one of those hymns that you have to sing all the way through, because it's what is known as a progressive hymn. It develops from one stage of being to quite another stage. From a place where in our Christian life we say, all of self and none of thee, to a place in where in full humiliation and humility, we are brought to the place where we have to say, it's none of self and it's all of thee. Our hymn book is not the only place where we find progressive hymns. There is a progressive hymn in the Bible, and it's this progressive hymn that we're going to talk about. It's called a hymn. It's called the Song of Solomon. And if you turn to that, our study today is going to be a review on the entire Song of Solomon as a progressive hymn. As you look at hymn 224, the one we sang, you notice that the entire theme is in those chorus lines. How it's all of self and none of thee, some of self and some of thee, less of self and more of thee, and finally none of self and all of thee. In the Song of Solomon, we have these chorus lines also, and they are progressive. There are three of them. They're found in chapter 2, verse 14. In chapter 6, verse 3, and in chapter 7, verse 10. And before we get into our study, we're going to read these three verses to note the progression in the hymn of the Song of Solomon. In chapter 2, verse 14, and immediately I've got a wrong verse down. Let me see if I can find it very quickly where it is. 2, verse 16. 2, 16. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He feedeth among the lilies. In chapter 6, verse 3, we find a similar statement, but quite different. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feedeth among the lilies. You notice how everything got transposed. No longer is it first, my beloved is mine, and I am his. But now it's first, I am my beloved's, and he is mine. In chapter 7, verse 10, we find another similar statement. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. By the third step of progression, all personal possession is gone. No longer he is mine, but his desire is toward me. Now the book of Song of Solomon has reached the place where it is none of self and all of thee. We're going to try to go through and notice the experiences that develop into this progression. And as we take these experiences, we're not taking it as it's so often done, as the Song of Solomon as an allegory of the church as a whole and Christ as a whole, nor in the more complicated storyline that has sometimes developed, where there is a third person, a shepherd, who is the true love of the Shunammite. But we're going to take it from a very personal standpoint. The personal Christian development that each Christian goes through to go through these stages of love. And by the way, these three stages of love that we're going to talk about are not only true of the relationship of Christ and his church, they are also true of any personal love relationship, man and woman, husband and wife. These same three stages should be gone through. Looking at this as our personal development as a Christian, we're going to notice the book is naturally divided into four sections. We've artificially divided into five, but it's naturally divided into four, as we'll notice in a progression. Chapter 1:1 through chapter 2:7 relate to our experiences during the drawing period of our Christian life, before we have any personal relationship with the Lord. Chapter 2:8 through chapter 3:5 deal with the experiences during our calling, when there is a very personal relationship, and yet prior to our consecration. Chapter 3:6 all the way through chapter 8:4, embodying two sections, deals with the experiences of our consecrated life, the choosing. But we can subdivide that, where 3:6 through 5:1 talks about the choosing as such, and 5:2 through 8:4 talk about the testings of the Christian life. And finally, chapter 8, verses 5 through 14, talk about the ultimate deliverance of the church. So with this outline before us, we're going to try going through the Song of Solomon somewhat rapidly because of time, and to give permission and time for questions at the end. The tone for the first section is shown in chapter 1, verse 4. Draw me. This is the drawing experience. Draw me, we will run after thee. The king hath brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in thee. We will remember thy love more than wine. The upright love thee. The drawing experiences happen to the upright. It is the natural drawing of the perfections of God as exemplified in Jesus Christ, and the effect that these perfections have upon that which remains in our natural character of the perfections that were left in Father Adam. It is this natural desire of the inferior to the superior, of the one who has lost much of these imperfections to the one who has much, that draw us into a closer relationship with the Lord. In verse 3, we have the real drawing power. Because of the savor of thy good ointments, thy name is as ointment poured forth, therefore do the virgins love thee. The good ointments here is the savor, the sweet savor of a life that is lived fully according to principle, a life that is lived in such a way as to be totally above reproach. The ointment that this leaves, the savor, as exemplified in the tabernacle when you had the incense sprinkled over the fire on the golden altar. He said, because of this sweet savor, we are drawn to him. Therefore, do the virgins love him. At this stage in our Christian development, as is said in verse 2, thy love is better than wine. It is not so much at this stage the doctrines of truth that are the attraction, but it is the love that we see in the exemplified life, where these doctrines are applied in the pattern of daily living This becomes the magnet that draws us to Him. But even as we are drawn, there is at the same time another effect that this observation has in our Christian life. The more we see His perfections, the more we are reminded of our own imperfections. And so in verse 4, she says, "I am black, but comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon." The style, the literary style, of the Book of Song of Solomon is what is known as an Oriental love poem. And in those poems, there is frequently a device that is used that is called parallelism, where four thoughts are expressed and need to be put into parallel columns to get the thought. The comparison here is, I am black at the tents of Kedar. I want to become comely as the curtains of Solomon. This is the sense of the original language. The one is describing her present recognition. What I see in myself is the blackness of a Bedouin tent. But what I see in you, and what I see the prospect of becoming by association with you, is the loveliness, the beauty of one of the curtains of Solomon. There is the recognition in verse 6 where this blackness comes from. I am black because the sun has shone upon me. Literally, I'm sunburned. But figuratively, we are black because the gospel light exposes our imperfections. And as a result, we are cognizant of our blackness. There's the recognition in verse 6. Although I have been made keeper of vineyards, my own vineyard I have not kept. The recognition that there is a deterioration in the role and work assigned to each individual to keep their life as a vineyard productive and fruitful. In verse 7, we begin noticing that at this stage, there is a vast separation between the woman and her prospective bridegroom, the one she loves. Tell me, O thou whom my soul loveth, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon. Why should I be as one that turns aside by the flocks of thy companions? So I'm not looking for the copies. I'm looking for the original. Where do you feed? There is in here two things. One, a recognition that presently, I am not with you. I am seeking you. And secondly, there is the intense desire to bridge that gap of separation between them. His answer is in verse 8. If you don't know, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock and feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tent. If you would find me, look in the paths of lowliness. If you want me, seek humility, and from humility you will find me. You remember the story of King David, how he was anointed? How all the brothers came before Samuel, each one with a prospect of being the next king of Israel. And one by one, the Lord turned them down. And finally, when all were turned down, including the last Eliab, that then the message came, is there not any more? I have one more, but he's out in the shepherd's fields. He's in the path of humility. That's the one the Lord wants, because man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. And that is the same lesson if we would find him. And when we have that, then the Lord responds to us, as in verse 9 and 9 through 11. I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses in Pharaoh's chariots. Thy cheeks are comely with rows of jewels, thy neck with chains of gold. We will make thee borders of gold with studs of silver. The noun in verse 9 is not company of horses, but my mare, my single horse. And here again we have to understand the Oriental feelings, where in that time and lifestyle, the closest thing to a man was his horse. Because this is what he relied upon. When you read of Muhammad, you read of his steed. When you read of Alexander, you read of his horse. The two are always considered as inseparable. And he said, I have compared thee to my inseparable companion. to the one that is my own unique possession. And it's not a point of lack of love, but expression of deep love. He says, I recognize a beauty in you, but a beauty that can be enhanced. And my first step toward enhancing this is to give you, and really what's described in verse 11 is a necklace. A necklace of golden beads on a silver thread. And these are the same golden beads that Peter describes when he says, wherefore unto given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, whereby you may be partakers of the divine nature. The divine promises threaded with the thread of truth is the first response of the Lord to us in this drawing. Our response, verses 12 to 14, while the king sits at his table, my spikenard sendeth forth the smell thereof. A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night between my breasts. My beloved is unto me as a cluster of camphor in the vineyards of En-Gedi. If in the Orient, the steed or the horse was man's most prized possession, the spices and the ointments were woman's most prized possession. And she says, you are to me the most prized possession I have. And says, I too have a perfume I would like to give. I have the potential of this perfume. But already her possessiveness is showing. I want you all night between my breasts. His response, you are fair, my love. You are fair, you have dove's eyes. The dove, throughout the Bible, the symbol of the Holy Spirit. You have spiritual perception. You have shown spiritual perception in this response to the drawing influences to me. Her response, behold, thou art fair, my male beloved. Yea, pleasant also, our bed is green, the beams of our house are cedar, our rafters are fir. Green, cedar, and fir have one thing in common. Greenness. Evergreenness. She desires an everlasting relationship. An everlasting relationship in the love pictured by the bed. An everlasting relationship in its sturdiness pictured by the beams of the house. An everlasting relationship in its spirituality pictured by the rafters and the roof, that which separates her from that which is above. But, she says, I am only a rose of Sharon, only a lily of the valleys. I'm just a little prairie flower. I'm no showy plant. I'm just a little flower of the field. And his response, oh, but as the lily among the thorns, so is my love among the daughters. I'm not looking at you as one flower compared to another. When I look to you, the rest are only as the thorns and not as the showy flowers. Her response, as the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. Notice she chooses the tree of fruitfulness. Because that is what we see in Christ during the drawing. His fruitfulness, his fruit-bearing ability. I sat under his shadow with great delight. And that's exactly what we do with that experience in our life. His fruit was sweet to my taste. He brings me to the banqueting house where I can share these fruits. His banner over me was love. Stay me with flagons, comfort me with apples. I am lovesick. His left hand is under my head. With his right hand, he embraces me. And then the chorus line that separates each of the section. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose, by the hinds of the field, that you stir not up, nor awake my love till he please. There have been many suggestions as to who the daughters of Jerusalem represent in the Song of Solomon. The one that we feel, and this is a suggestion, is most compatible is the one that was most frequently used in the early days of the truth movement. You find it many times in the convention reports. Natural Israel. And that there is this desire, there's first the knowledge that the next stage of God's plan will be with natural Israel. But there is this fervent desire in the development of the church. Oh, don't go into that next stage. Don't awaken my love from his present situation until this relationship that I have with you is fully developed. Then go to the next stage. Don't awaken him until he please. Let this come to its fruition. Passing now to the next stage, the calling of God. from chapter 2, 8 to chapter 3, verse 5. Here we find that instead of the significant word, draw me, we have now the voice of the Beloved coming into prominence, a very personal voice. The voice of my Beloved, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. He's like a rower, young hart. He stands on the other side of our wall. He looks forth at our windows. He shows himself through the lattice. At this stage, there is still a separation between the two parties. But now there is a nearness in the separation. Now he is within eyesight. In the first section, she couldn't even find him. In this section, she has found him. She sees him. But there is a wall, a house wall, separating her from him. And this wall, we suggest, is the wall of unbelief and self. That which restrains us at the calling time from a closer relationship with him. Despite this wall, we can see him. We see him through the windows of prophecy, where we have prophetic pictures of him, pictures of his life. We see him through history. We see him through the scriptures. These are the great windows that we get a view of how he operates. We see him through the lattice work, the cross-hatchedness of our experiences and providential overrulings. In both of these, we see him skipping upon the mountain. These mountains, in verse 17, are called the mountains of Bether, or, left untranslated, the mountain of separation or sanctification. In verse 10, we have the call itself. My Beloved spake. He said, rise up, my love, my fair one, come away. Come away from your wall. Get around that wall and come and be with me. Don't have the separation between us anymore. I am on a mountain that requires separation from where you are. Where I am, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear, the time of the singing of birds has come, the voice of the turtle is heard, the fig tree puts her green figs, the vine has a tender grape. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Springtime is the time of new life, when life comes again upon the earth. The true springtime is the millennial kingdom, when resurrection comes. But for the church, springtime can be even now. As Paul says in Romans, we have now received the atonement. We can now come into new life. And the Lord is saying, where I am, there is new life. Come and join me. My dove, my spiritual one, you are in the clefts of the rock. You are connected to the ransom. That's the secret place of the stairs. Let me see thy countenance. Let me hear thy voice. For sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. The Lord has a very personal interest in his people, and he calls them very individually and very personally. But there's a problem. Take the foxes. Those little foxes that spoil the vines, for as yet, our vines have very tender grapes. At this stage, we have not developed the strong fruitage. There are just tender grapes. And little doubts, little questions, little fears, little trials, little troubles come in. And he said, take these aside. Don't let them spoil that fruitage that can be yours so well. And her response, the first of our theme texts, my Beloved is mine, and I am his. He feeds among the lilies. She says, I accept this call. I move forward. I can have that which my heart has so desired, the love of my Beloved. I recognize that his fruitage is among the lilies. Until the day break and the shadows flee away, turn, my Beloved, and be thou like a roe or young hart upon the mountains of Bether. Her appeal to him, that until this nighttime of sin and sorrow is over, please remain on these hills of separation, these hills of sanctification, to continually draw me, to continually call me to your side. Oh, by night on my bed I sought him whom I so loved. I sought him, but I found him not. I couldn't sleep for fear that I would lose him. But now I will rise. I will go about the city and the streets, and in the broadways I will seek him whom my soul loves. She did that. I sought him, but I couldn't find him. The watchmen that go about the city found me. And I said to them, have you seen whom my soul loveth? And I think of this particularly in connection with Christendom. That in all the streets of Christendom, there has been a very poor percentage who have been able to find him whom their soul loves. The watchmen there don't know where he is. But you notice in verse 4, it was only a little while after I left them, after I passed out from Christendom, that I did find him. I held him. I wouldn't let him go until I brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her that conceived me. Here she comes now to finalizing that relationship. And then the chorus, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up nor awake my love to be pleased. May this plan not go on to its next stage, until this stage has found its full fruition, until the calling that I have made sure can be joined by the election, and I can make that sure as well, the time to develop into the full fruitage that he's looking for in me. In our third section, chapter 3, verse 6 through chapter 5, verse 1, there is no separation between the man and the woman. They are constantly together. And this is the section of the choosing. Once we have established a relationship with Christ through a full and unreserved consecration, then we have a relationship that can be permanent, that does not need to have any true separation. And it starts with the unity of the two. It says, who is this that comes out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? Behold his bed, which is Solomon. 80 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. They hold swords, they're expert in war. Every man has a sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. Instead of fear, read dangers in the night. King Solomon made himself a chariot of the wood of Lebanon. He made the pillars of silver, the bottom of gold, the covering of purple. Stop there a second. Let's go back. Notice what she's seen thus far. It's a very unusual picture. It's a picture of contrast. I see a warrior, a mighty warrior, coming up out of the wilderness. I see him accompanied by 70 valiant men. He's riding so fast that the sand clouds behind him are like pillars of smoke. But he's perfumed. He's perfumed with myrrh and frankincense. A picture of a perfumed warrior. It's this contrast that she sees in her Lord that is so attractive to her. He is the strong one in my life. He's also the gentle one. He's also my love. And even the perfumes, the myrrh of bitter experiences, the frankincense of pleasant experiences, in both of these he omits the same odor. And then she sees a chariot, an immense chariot, and she sees it in the gold and the silver and all the luxury thereof. But reading the end of verse 10, the middle is paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem. The recognition that he's always and ever for one people, natural Israel. That he rides for them. That he loves them. This does not leave this whole picture. In verse 11, she sees still another picture. Go forth, daughters of Zion, not Jerusalem this time. Behold, King Solomon with the crown, or with his mother crowned him, in the day of his espousals, in the day of the gladness of his heart. Here she sees him as a king. But she sees his kingship directly connected with his marriage relationship. Crown him as he is crowned in the day of his espousals. This is the first section where we find the term espousals and spouse used. Because up to this time, during the drawing and calling, we don't have that relationship. We are a beloved. We are a girlfriend. But now we become a spouse. Now there is an engagement entered into. His response, verse 4, 1 to, chapter 4, 1 to 5, behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair, thou hast dove's eyes. And then he goes into a beautiful description of her that we won't take the time to analyze phrase by phrase. But basically he says, you again have shown that you have spiritual perception. And because of this, I see more beauty than I saw during the drawing. There you had comely cheeks. Here I notice your hair. Here I notice your neck. Here I notice your breath. Here he notices the whole, because she has grown in her development to him. Her response is in verse 6. Until the day break and the shadows flee away, I will get me to the mountain of myrrh, to the hill of frankincense. This is one of my favorite verses because it shows how the Lord psychologically works with us. He praises us. He says, I see beauty in you. And our response is, if you see beauty, I'm going to try to become more beautiful. It's the same way with any interpersonal relationship. If you praise another person, they see you respect them, and they strive to live up to the image you hold. And that's what the Lord uses with us. And says, I have appreciated in you the combination of myrrh and frankincense. I will now go to the places where I can get the experiences, so I can have myrrh and frankincense. I will be like you with the same two fragrances, the bitter and the good. His response, oh, you are fair, my love. There is no spot in thee. He realizes a perfect response. The same thing you see in Ephesians, in that other love song. When he says he will preserve the church, so that in her will be no spot, nor wrinkle, nor any such thing, that he may present her unto himself a holy bride. Come with me. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. That term is now used, spouse. Come with me from the top of Amana, from the top of Shinar, from Hermon, from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards, from Hiram, Ohio, from Portland, Oregon, from Chicago, from Detroit, from wherever you are. Come with me. Come out. Come and join me where I am. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. Another term. No longer just a spouse, but now a sister as well. One who has the same father and the same mother. One who has the same heavenly father and the same covenant mother relationship. And he goes into another description of her beauty, again adding to it. But in this description, he sees that her beauty is incomplete and only potential. In verse 12, a garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Oh, I see a garden, but nobody else can see it. It's closed in. I see a fountain, but it's shut up. But notice in verse 15, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters and streams from Lebanon. That's the potential he will realize from his development and his work with the church, taking away the enclosure of their garden, taking away the stone that shuts up the fountain. And how? Verse 16, awake, O north wind, come thou south, blow upon my garden, that the spices thereof may flow out. You need the cross experiences of the cold north wind and the soft experiences of the warm south wind. These will come alternately. You will have the hard experiences, you will have the soft experiences, so that you can be no longer a garden enclosed, but a garden exposed. No longer a fountain shut up, but a stream of living water, bringing life to all with whom, who come in contact with you. Her response, let my beloved come into his garden and eat his present fruits. His response, I am coming to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. And he turns outward, eat, O friends, drink, yea, drink abundantly, O beloved. The recognition here is that the Lord deals with us in a garden. A garden is a place of fruitfulness, a place where things grow. As we're going to notice, especially in the next section, that's what the whole book's about. Turning us away from the intellectual into the spiritual. Turning us away from the academic into the fruit-bearing aspects of life. Because that's where the Lord develops and grows, and that's why he has chosen the church. In the next section, which is during the choosing, and that's why we don't have the refrain separating the sections, but in the next section, it deals with testings. And in this section, we find a separation again between the bride and the groom. They are not together. They're not united. She says, I sleep, but my heart waketh. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled, for my head is filled with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night. I put off my coat. How shall I put it on? I have washed my feet. How shall I defile them? My beloved put in his hand by the hole of the door, and my bowels were moved for him. I rose up to open to my beloved. My hands dropped with myrrh, and my fingers with sweet-smelling myrrh upon the handles of the lock. I opened to my beloved. But my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone. My soul failed when he spake. I sought him, but I couldn't find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. This section is a heartbreaking section. It's a section we often apply, and not improperly, to the great company, because it represents a testing and trial which, if not conquered, can put us in the great company. It has that potential. But it has the potential also of being a test. It's a place where he describes those aspects in our consecrated lives, and probably we've each gone through them, where because of experiences, we feel temporarily separated from the Lord. We love him. But all of a sudden, you notice in verse 2, no longer does she call him her spouse. We don't feel that close marital relationship, a potential marital relationship that is described. We find that self and unbelief have again taken their toll. That we don't really feel like putting forth the effort to put back on our coat, on our shoes, to be activated to seek him. And finally, when love works long enough, when love finally stirs us from the stupor we've been in, then we find we open the door to him that he's not there. This chapter is so parallel to the 23rd chapter of Job. You may recall that chapter where it says that I sought for him and I couldn't find him. I looked on the right hand and he wasn't there. I looked on the left and I couldn't see him. I went forward and he wasn't there. I looked back and he wasn't there. That every place we look, all of a sudden we notice this separation from the Lord. During this period, there's a search. She again goes to the watchman. They don't help her. They smite her. Because there is no help in Christendom for this answer. She goes to the daughters of Jerusalem. The daughters of Jerusalem said, we've heard about so many beloveds. Who is your beloved more than any other beloved? But there is no faith there to show her and point her the way. But it's enough to waken her. And she turns and says, who is my beloved? She tells him from verse 9 to verse 16. Or verse 10 to 16. My beloved is white. He's ruddy. He's the chiefest among 10,000. His head is the most fine gold. His locks are bushy. And she goes and describes him in the most poetic of terms. She is called back again to her first love, to recognizing that image she had first seen. And when she sees that image, it not only thrills her, it thrills these daughters of Jerusalem who've been talking to her. Where is your beloved gone, O thou fairest? Where is he turned aside that we may seek him with thee? And in chapter 6, verse 2, she finds him again. I know where he is. My beloved has gone into his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed in the gardens, to gather lilies. She realizes that his place has been in the area of fruitfulness. And the only reason I haven't been with him is I haven't been in the area of fruitfulness. I have not been in the garden. I have been separated for him. And when she realizes that, then she comes to step 2 of her love relationship. I am my beloved's, and he is mine. No longer does she control the relationship. Now she says the first and important thing is, I belong to him. And because I belong to him, therefore, he is mine. Everything has been turned around. Self has dropped to second place. The Lord has assumed the first place in her life. In Job 23, that we referred to earlier, after it says, I went forward and to the right and to the left and back, and I couldn't find him. The next verse corresponds to this verse. But he knows the way that I take. And when I am come through, I shall be as gold tried in the fire. The recognition that even though I cannot trace the steps before me, I have confidence in the one to whom I belong. And I am my beloved's. And therefore, he is mine. And his response, oh, you're beautiful. You're beautiful, my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem. You're terrible as an army with banners. That's a horrible description, isn't it? You're beautiful as an army with banners. That word terrible there, don't think of as terrible as we use the word. But awesome, or majestic. That's the thought of it. You're majestic as an army returning victorious, having its conquering banners. You have gained the victory. You have learned the lesson. You have found me at the time of separation, and therefore you are in the place where you are awesome as this. And he goes into another description. Each description by the Lord of the church is more complete, more rounded than the prior one. He always picks up the emblems from the first and adds to it. What he adds in this description is superiority. Starting in verse 8, there are 70 queens. There are 80 concubines. There are virgins without number. But my dove, my spiritual one, my undefiled, is the only one of her mother, the choice one of her that bare her. The daughter saw her and blessed her. The queens and the concubines, they praise her. Who is she, looking forth like the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, majestic as a conquering army, waving its banners? Here again is that description that now you have proven through these testings that of all the virgins, wise and foolish, you are the only one. Through your faithfulness in these testings, you are the one that I have chosen. He combines the elements of the moon and the sun, just like you see in Revelation 12, verse 1. It says, I saw a woman standing upon the moon, clothed in the sun. It combines the elements of the law and the gospel. He sees again that victory. Her response, verse 11 and 12, I went down into the garden, the place where he is, into the garden of nuts to see the fruits of the valley, to see whether the vine flourished and the pomegranates budded. Or ever I was aware, my soul made me as the chariots of Aminadab. Here she says, knowing where he is, I knew why he was there. I went down there. I started checking on the fruits of my spirit. Am I growing? Am I developing? Am I coming into Christ-likeness? Am I producing that fruitfulness that he would have from me? And she said, I did this like in a trance. I wasn't even aware that I did it. Again, going back to Job 23, it was no awareness that brought her to that position where she said, he knows the way that I take. The Lord, by his providence, leads us over these separated experiences to be back with him. And his response to us is return. Return, O Shulamite, return, that we may look upon thee. And she responds, what do you see in the Shulamite? And he said, well, I see it as the company of two armies. He said, I see a division there between the wise and the foolish. I see a division in the amount of growth and development. But I also see a beauty. He again describes her beauty, this time of the church, chapter 7. How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter. The joints of thy thighs are like jewels. And he goes again into a long description, covers the first 9 verses of this chapter. The unique thing about this description is here he notices certain elements that you would never say to your girlfriend. At least I hope you wouldn't. You've got a neck like a tower of ivory. He talks about her big nose in this section. What he is seeing is growth. And that's the thing to look at, is the growth aspect. You have progressed. And in this growth, I see a stature like a palm tree. I see breasts like clusters of grapes. And he describes what he sees within the growth. Her response is verses 10 to 13. And here again in verse 10 is the final development of love. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. No longer does she need to claim him. He is my unique possession. But now she is thrilled that his desire is toward us, that he is working with us, and I don't need to have this feeling of he is mine and mine alone, and no one else dare touch him. But now she realizes, I am just happy with his response to me. And then she can get on with the important part, the work ahead. Starting in verse 11, come, my beloved, let us, for the first time we find the plural pronoun, now together they work, let us go down into the field, let us lodge in the villages, both in the harvest field and in the villages of mankind where we can share their experiences. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let's see if that vine flourishes, if the tender grape is appearing, if the pomegranates bud. There will I give thee my pledges of love. My love, as King James puts it. Here is that development now that says, let's get busy. Let's get onto it. Let's have real fruitfulness. And she realized, I'm not developing it for you. And you're not just developing it in me, but it's our project. It's our garden. And then she adds a special fruit. And the mandrakes. The mandrakes give a smell. At our gates are all manner of pleasant fruit. Perhaps you recall in the story of Leah and Rachel how Leah's son went out and found mandrakes and how she traded them for the night of sleep with Jacob and how it produced fruitfulness. The mandrake was the tradition of fruit, of fertility, the symbol of fertility. And now she is going forward and says, I see this relationship developing not just into a love between you and me, but I see children upon the scene. I see fertility. I see a growth in this relationship. This is something she could not see as long as she had to claim them for herself. But now that she is willing to share his love, I am my beloved's and his desire is toward me, she is now ready for the fruitfulness of the children that will bring forth. And then he responds by reviewing their life. And they say that in the original Hebrew, the tense is quite different than in English. And that he's saying, thou wert, not O that thou wert, but thou wert like my brother that sucked the breast of my mother. I found thee without. I kissed thee and I wasn't ashamed of it. I led thee, I brought thee into my mother's house. No one could instruct me. I would cause thee to drink of spiced wine and the juice of my pomegranates. That's the review of the whole experience. The Lord found you and me, not inside of the house of consecration, but outside and the camp. And he came out and he kissed us out there. He brought us into that house. He brought us in there because it was his mother's house. He said, you are like my brothers, the same father, the same mother. And now he said, you're not here to instruct me, but I'm going to instruct you. I'm going to give you both the spiced wine of the doctrines of my plan, the kingdom, and the juice of my pomegranates, the fruitage of the Spirit. These are both yours. His left hand is under my head. His right hand embraces me. Oh, I charge you, daughters of Jerusalem, don't stir up. Don't awake my love until he pleads. I'm too happy. I don't want this broken. Not until this experience has reached its fruition is that next experience ready to come. And so the chorus ends this section. And we come to the final section, the deliverance of the church. Who is this that cometh from the wilderness? You saw that earlier when she first recognized the Lord. Now it's somebody different. It's leaning upon her beloved. Now it's Christ and the church coming together out of the wilderness condition. He says, I raised you up under the tree of fruitfulness, the apple tree. There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth to bear me. Her response, set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm. And now again we come into that parallelism we talked about. On the one hand, this new love, true love, is strong as death. Stronger than death is the literal. It has superseded death. But that first love, that possessive love, that love that says, I am my beloved, my beloved is mine, that love that first said, my beloved is mine, that jealousy was cruel as the grave. The coals thereof were the coals of fire, which had the most vehement flame. But this true love, that's stronger than death, many waters cannot quench it. Floods cannot drown it. Even the most dangerous element, if a man give all the substance of his house, it would be condemned. Materialism can't stop it, no matter what comes against it. Then we switch to the plural pronoun, Christ and the church. Ah, but there's another thing. We have a little sister, and she hath no breasts. What shall we do for her in the day when someone will ask her hand in marriage, when she'll be spoken for? There's a dual response. Well, if she be a wall, we will build upon her a palace of silver. But if she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. I am a wall. My breasts are like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. The imagery here is that of a virgin. If she has been a wall, has maintained her virginity, even though being foolish, is still a virgin, and says, we will build upon that. We'll build a silver palace. Not gold, not that which is preserved for the bride, but there'll be a spiritual reward. But if she's been a door, if she's lost her virginity, if she's let others in, then we're going to have to enclose her in the same wood that they make coffins out of, in eternal death, in boards of silver, in boards of cedar. But for herself, she says, I am a wall. I am a virgin. My breasts have grown. They're like towers for sympathy and nourishment for others. And then dealing with the future, she begins talking about a number of vineyards. Solomon had, past tense, a vineyard at Baal Hamon. That vineyard he let out into keepers. Every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. That's the vineyard you find in Isaiah chapter 5. Natural Israel. A vineyard that did not produce its fruitage. But my vineyard, the second vineyard, my vineyard which is mine, that's still before me. This is the vineyard you read about in Proverbs 31, where the faithful wife takes her money and goes and buys a vineyard and cultivates it. This is the vineyard that earlier she said, my own vineyard I have not kept. But through these experiences, she has been brought to the keeping of her vineyard, and that's before her. And Solomon, you must have 1,000. The work that is in the past is only a small beginning. Who knows what works lie ahead? Who knows what future vineyards are still there? And if you've got 1,000, I know that those who help you keep them, the church, will have their share, their 200. In verse 13, we find another voice entering for the only time. It's mankind's voice. O you that dwell in the gardens, the companions hearken to your voice. Cause me to hear it. Cause those who have not heard this voice to hear it and to come back to their reward. And the book ends with the same thought that the Bible ends with. Make haste, my beloved. Be thou to me like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of spices. Remember how the Bible ends. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. May this work happen. May it come about in our lives. May we have not only the experiences of the drawing and the calling, but as we go into the experiences of the choosing, may we endure whatever tests may come so that we may get over the separations that come between us, so that we may pass from love to love, from that selfish love that first says, my beloved is mine, to the less selfish love that says, I am my beloved's, and he is mine, to the unselfish love that is content with a mere statement, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. What we've expressed, brethren, have been some thoughts and a synopsis that we appeals to us as a thread that holds the Song of Solomon together into our personal lives. I'm sure that as we've looked at the Song of Solomon, and I think many of us have looked at it for many times, we may have developed it from various aspects, and they're not necessarily contradictory aspects. There are sometimes different levels of the same mind. As you mine the ore that's at each level, there's a beauty to that level. But in looking at it this way, we're trying to see the progression that can develop in our lives. Now we're told to leave some time for questions, so I guess we're come to that time for any comments or questions from the brethren in the audience. David Rice. I think the mic's on its way, Dave. Okay. You might as well wait, Dave. It's almost there. Okay. It goes better on the tape recorder. They say to wait for the mic.
Well, Brother Carl, I really appreciated the service. But I was wondering, you did take it from the personal level. And I know I've heard some thoughts concerning Songs of Solomon that take different parts of it at different time elements during the Gospel Age, like, for instance, during the harvest. Is it your thought that there are some time applications here on a different level? Or do you think that there's nothing specific as far as time? For instance, when he comes skipping like a roe upon the mountains, does this refer to a second advent or the deliverance of the church at the end of the age? Is there another level here, or is your thinking that may not really be correct?
My own thinking on the subject is that there are many, many levels, not only to Song of Solomon, but to almost any scripture in the Bible, that we can take them in a contextual setting and probably come closer to the intended meaning. But within the outside of the contextual setting, there are many passages which by themselves can form beautiful lessons. The second chapter, I've heard interpreted also from the standpoint of the second advent. And I think it makes a beautiful lesson. I don't think it works in context with the whole. But I think taken as itself, it can be a lesson very beautiful and very worth considering. There we generally view the lattice work and the walls a little differently. So we view it as how the Lord shows himself through the times and seasons at the second advent and calls one. I notice in the writings of the early truth movement, it is treated both ways, although more frequently it is treated as the wall of unbelief in self and as a picture of consecration.
Thank you.
Yes, Keith.
Brother Carl, I really appreciated this, but I'm just kind of wondering, how did you tie in those last few verses in the book?
Which specific verses?
Probably 12, 13, and 14.
Okay, verses 12 I view as being the prospect of the eternity that's ahead. You notice the word, and it's an italicized word, so it's not necessarily a correct word. But says, thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000. As being the thought that having one vineyard and seeing what it's produced, I imagine, Solomon, you've got endless number of vineyards ahead, and that it may picture the works of the future, whatever they might be. It may picture something else. It may picture his works with all mankind. You know, it could very well picture that as well. This is the thought that appealed to me the most. Verse 13, I take as mankind's response to the whole. They are not a active character in the book. They are the observers. And as the observers, they say, we have seen this hearkening of the voice of your companions. We too want to hear that voice. And they will. All men shall hear his voice and come forth. And the last just being an intense desire verse to show that it may come to pass. Any other comments, questions? Yes, Ron Chesney.
Is there any significance, Brother Carl, to the 12th verse, that those that keep the fruit of those vineyards is 200? Do you have a comment on the 200, the significance, or is there a significance?
Yes, I don't know. I looked at the number 200. The only thing I made from it at all was that it's a small percentage of the 1,000. And that's saying that those who help you, which I would take as the speaker, the church, they will have their share. I don't know whether the 200 or 20% make any difference. I looked at it both ways, the 200 and 20%. There is the thought from the law about the fifth more, but I didn't mean to tie in. So I have no solid thought on that. David?
You mentioned very early in your discussion about the thought about three people involved in the narrative here, Solomon, this woman, and the Shulam, and a shepherd. I didn't really get your point. Are you suggesting that... did you utilize that in your interpretation? If you did, I didn't catch it.
No, I did not utilize it in the interpretation. There are two primary concepts as to the storyline of the Song of Solomon as a book. Now here I'm not talking its interpretation in our lives, but merely as the story itself. The one concept is that it's merely a love story between Solomon and the woman he loves more than anybody else. The other concept is that there is a third person, that this woman is already engaged to a shepherd. You find the term shepherd appearing many times through here, and it seems to be in sharp contrast with Solomon, and that Solomon is trying to woo her away from the shepherd. If that is the storyline, the lesson in that story would be that our love for the Lord must be stronger, that strong enough to overcome all the temptations that the world can put before us. The big city of Jerusalem, the court, the harem, King Solomon with all his glory, should not mean anything to our simple shepherd that we're in love with. So from one aspect, it's a lesson of putting aside the temptations of materialism. From the other, it's an aspect of just a pure developing love relationship. I was not treating him either of those aspects. I was treating him the aspect of personal devotional study. Anyone else? And your thoughts may also want to include an answer to Ron's question about the 200 sometime. If anybody got a thought, we'll welcome that. Brother Lorenz.
We've enjoyed your lovely thoughts, Brother Carl, on many points. Some time ago, as you came to Solomon 4:1 concerning our Lord's first observance of the bride, his spouse-to-be, that he notices her eyes. And this is physically true, we know, in the natural family. But what he observes in her is why he likens her to dove's eyes. We understand the bird, the dove, only mates once. Therefore, this is